Welcome to Switchblade Sisters, where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm April Wolfe. Every week, I invite a new female filmmaker on, a writer, director, actor, or producer, and we talk in depth about one of their fave genre films, perhaps one that influenced their own work in some strange way. And today, I'm very excited to have actor Madeline Arthur here. Hi, Madeline.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me. This is really exciting.
Well, let me introduce you to our listeners. Madeline is an American-Canadian actress who continues to impress critics and audiences alike through her work in television and film. She was born and raised in Vancouver, training for a long while to be a gymnast before acting called to her, which is, I mean, you're using your body, and I mean, there's certain overlaps.
They're both performative in certain ways.
Yeah, right.
For sure.
Her first credited role came in R.L. Stine's The Haunting Hour in 2011. From there, she had a small role in The Killing before jumping to a recurring role in the CW's The Tomorrow People. But it was her role playing Amy Adams' daughter in Tim Burton's Big Eyes that really broke her career. She then starred in the ABC thriller series The Family as young Willa Warren, daughter of Joan Allen, and earned roles thereafter in The X-Files, The Magicians, and DC Legends of Tomorrow before she got cast in a plum role as Christine in Netflix's smash hit To All the Boys I've Loved Before. So I'm sure people have seen you, right? There's a large quotient of horror fans who also love
romantic comedies.
Exactly.
Yes.
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 It's a role that she's also officially set to reprise for the sequel. Now, Madeline is starring in Color Out of Space, opposite Nicolas Cage and Golden Globe nominee Jolie Richardson, directed by Richard Stanley, who's kind of making his comeback right now. The film is an adaptation of a Lovecraft story about a meteorite that wreaks havoc on a small town, and you'll be able to see Madeline in TNT's Snowpiercer series coming up soon, too. I think that's premiering April or March.
I think it's in May, actually.
In May?
Yeah.
Okay, great. So May, and that I know has already been picked up for a season two, so you're just busy. You've got a lot of things going on.
Yes, this has been a spectacular year. I'm very grateful. It's been a wild, wild ride.
Well, we're about to talk about another wild ride because, Madeline, the movie that you chose to talk about today is Adaptation. Can you give us a little explanation on why this is one of your fave genre films?
I chose Adaptation because I think it's one of the most unique films that I've ever seen. I think that it's so fascinating, all the layers that it plays with in storylines, and is such a delight to watch. And I also think that it's one of Nick Cage's most brilliant performances, the idiosyncrasies that he gives to playing Charlie and Donald Kaufman. He plays twins in the movies. It's so genius.
For those of you who haven't seen Adaptation, today's episode will obviously give you some spoilers, but that shouldn't stop you from listening before you watch. As always, my motto is that it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. Still, if you would like to pause and watch Adaptation first, this is your chance. Now, let me introduce Adaptation with a short synopsis. Written by Charlie Kaufman and directed by Spike Jonze for release in 2003, Adaptation tells the story of a fictionalized Charlie Kaufman and his overly confident twin brother, Donald Kaufman. Charlie is hired to adapt Susan Orlean's book, The Orchid Thief, but he's struggling with an enormous sense of self-doubt while carefree Donald crashes in his house and proclaims he's going to be a screenwriter, just like Charlie.
Hey, Charles, you'll be glad. I have a plan to get me out of your house pronto.
A job is a plan. Is your plan a job?
Drum roll, please. I'm going to be a screenwriter, like you.
Charlie goes to New York to get insights from Susan, but is too nervous to speak to her. And then he gets news that Donald's dumb action thriller script is selling for a hefty sum.
Listen, the other reason I called was The Three? It's just amazing.
I don't know what that is.
Donald's script! Smart, edgy thriller. It's the best script I've read all year.
Which makes Charlie rethink everything he knows about writing. And he attends a Robert McKee writing seminar. Robert McKee is a real person, and he is played by Brian Cox in this movie. Charlie decides to enlist Donald to help him and sends him to interview Susan instead. Donald, surprisingly, finds that Susan is being a little secretive with her answers, and something's not quite right.
She's lying.
What do you mean? What happened?
Nothing. She said everything right. Too right.
Maybe they're too right because they're true.
Did
you embarrass me?
People who answer questions too late are liars.
So the brothers decide to follow Susan as she goes down to Florida, meeting with John LaRoche, the orchid thief. They witness Susan taking a rare orchid-based drug and making love to LaRoche, but Susan catches Charlie watching them.
Are you going to write about this in your screenplay?
I really don't know what this is.
He's lying.
And she decides he must be killed to protect Susan's reputation. Susan holds Charlie at gunpoint and drives him into the Everglades swamps, but Donald helps him escape, and they hide together until LaRoche shoots Donald. However, they do escape in their car, and we think everything is going to be okay, but then they collide with a truck and Donald dies. LaRoche then chases Charlie into a swamp, but he's eaten by an alligator and Charlie gets away. Susan is arrested and Charlie returns home to finish his script, and for the first time in his life, he feels hope.
Anyway, it's done, and that's something. So, Kaufman drives off from his encounter with Amelia, filled for the first time with hope.
It's hard to say that that's the movie. It is the plot points, of course, but there's so much
more to it.
Yes. First off, we should talk about the fact that Nicolas Cage is playing a fictionalized version of Charlie Kaufman, and he's playing two versions of him, which is
even more crazy and wild and so interesting to look at. And Donald Kaufman actually isn't a real person. He's just a completely fictionalized character. So Charlie Kaufman writing himself into his movie because he was struggling to adapt this book, and then having Nick play both of those characters, and you really see the subtleties between the two.
Yeah, absolutely.
And some of the most exciting scenes to me in the movie are when you see them in one room and Nick's reacting to himself, mm-hmm. and you completely see that these are two totally different people. They're polar opposites
yes.
in so many ways. And I think it's just like a masterclass in acting.
Yeah, and let me get into a little bit of what Nick Cage was doing to study up on this. He said, "My impression of Charlie Kaufman is that he is a brilliant artist and is very passionate about his craft and loaded with self-doubt and insecurities that compel him to dig a little deeper and free himself. I think he uses this pressure to build the character. I spent a lot of time with Charlie analyzing that. I interviewed him exhaustively. I think he was happy when that part of the process was over, and I burned all the tapes out of respect for him. Sometimes we get into this paranoid place together where he would come to the set and I'd see him scrutinizing me, playing him, and I would get uncomfortable and wouldn't want to be there. And then I would take him to lunch or dinner and scrutinize him and see what kind of moves I could get to put in the part. And he would suddenly take the menu and start flapping it under his arms like a chicken. And I'd think, are you messing with me to see if that would end up in the movie?" Is that something that actors would strive to want to do, is play a character of someone who actually exists? Because, I mean, we see this in you know, a lot of, like, Academy Awards, we tend to give them to people who are, you know, playing real people.
Yes.
And that's almost a tradition of you know, the acting category. And I'm just curious about, from an actor's perspective, of what that means. Like, is it something that you jump at the chance to do because there is someone who you can either sit down and talk with or listen to tapes of and kind of inform your character in that way?
Oh, I mean, I think so. I think that it's, I mean, I have actually had the opportunity to play a real life character in Big Eyes, and I feel like it's this huge honor when you're channeling someone else's life and bringing it to the screen.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for an actor, and I think on a larger scale, if you're copying someone with really specific mannerisms, I can only imagine that it would be a great challenge. But also, usually these people, real life people that are brought to the screen, have these really special stories to be told.
Yeah.
And I feel like you get to play with so many things. If you're channeling someone real, you're playing with accent, you're playing with mannerisms. And I think it's also a huge responsibility when doing that. And so I think that's probably why actors are drawn to it. And as I said, I feel like the stories, it's that truth is stranger than fiction. And that's why mm-hmm. we see so many of these well-known people being portrayed in film.
And I have to say also, I mean, there's a lot that we can talk about with Nick Cage in this movie.
Yes.
He said, quote, "There's Donald and Charlie and these twin brothers, and there's me, whatever part of myself I bring to this script. And when I see the film, I divorce myself from it. I don't really see myself. I don't know what I see. I don't see me. They don't look very good either. And he's so uncomfortable that it makes me uncomfortable. The scene in the diner when she serves him the key lime pie, I feel so uncomfortable for him. I want to hide under a table myself." I mean, it's hard to talk about acting in this kind of thing that you have to go through. But yeah, he's saying that he's not himself. He is bringing himself
to
but
it.
But what does that mean?
But there's still a disconnect because he's so, I mean, when you're acting, you're so connected in the character. And then I feel like every actor has a different way of watching themselves on screen. I feel like I connect with the way that Nick says he is watching this other person on the screen who is him but who isn't him.
Yeah.
And I mean, that scene when he's in the diner is just, I mean, he's so endearing though at the same time that your heart kind of breaks for him.
You know, there is, it's an interesting thing too watching that because if you've seen Charlie Kaufman, the real Charlie Kaufman talk, Nick Cage isn't actually doing an impression of him. It's a really different, like he's creating whole cloth. A new person or two new people out of this because there is a certain kind of everyone. I think a lot of people love it when Nick Cage goes Nick Cage, you know, and he gets like big and like he's not.
And that's not one of those movies.
No, yeah, he's not afraid to go big, and I appreciate that in an actor. But there is a kind of remarkable subtlety that he has in this movie that. I think people don't often appreciate in what he's doing, but it's just like even communicating in his eyes of being uncomfortable, of being endearing is what you're saying.
Totally. Like, I mean, even off the top of the movie when it's just over black and all we hear is his voiceover and we're just plunged into his inner monologue. And I mean, I think it's so relatable because we all have these moments where we're like, why am I moving my hands like this? And why am I looking like that? And oh, why did I just say that? It's I feel like. Any, if you don't relate to that, wow, I'm good for you.
I know. There's so much too. I mean, you just brought up the voiceover and the inner monologue of this, and that's a huge part of this movie. And it's also meta in the sense that there's Robert McKee, the screenwriting teacher, is just like, you're a hack if you're doing voiceover in a movie, and Charlie Kaufman is doing it to the hilt because
exactly, and like the deus ex machina at the end.
Yes. And I am a person who is, I don't love absolutism when it comes to art because I think that you can make things work against the rules. And, you know, if you look at, for instance, there's that Netflix show, You, Sarah Gamble's show, You, and I think that that does a really great job with voiceover.
She's great.
She also came on the show, and it's funny, Sarah Gamble, she chose to do Being John Malkovich.
No way! And she wrote, she's one of the creators of The Magicians.
Exactly.
So she's a very talented
woman. Very talented. So you guys chose the two Charlie
That's
Kaufman
hilarious.
Movies from your episodes. And I think that doing voiceover is something that you really have to find a great actor to do because it seems like it's a different skill. And I was wondering if you had, you know, because I'm sure that you're doing ADR at least as an actor, which is, I think, probably a different kind of skill too. Could you talk about that a little bit or, you know, the challenges of that kind of thing?
For sure. I mean, I think with ADR, I feel like I haven't done a ton of like voiceover itself where it's just voiceover over a scene, but with ADR it's kind of, I always find you're kind of mimicking the movements and trying to get back into that zone and also not totally going off base with your voice to match your face because that's never
suddenly
a good
you've
thing.
You've got a vibrato,
yeah,
you know,
you're like screaming or something, but your face is neutral. That would be really bad. But with voiceover, I think that all of even ADR, I mean, there are so many different parts to acting in the process of making a movie. Like, auditioning is totally different than when you're actually on set and working with other actors and blocking and hitting your marks. And then you have ADR, which is a different skill set. And then I imagine voiceover. I'm trying to think now. Have I done, like, a specific voiceover? I think I did, like, a video game thing long ago. But It that too is a different set, and it's kind of like your podcast. Like with podcasts, you have such a good podcast voice, and I feel like that in itself is a skill that is, you know, pleasant and wonderful to listen to the ears. I think they're all different parts of the, not to sound to crazy, but parts of the instrument and...
Yeah. And, you know, I'm curious, too, like for... Okay. Obviously, you were acting opposite Nick Cage in your most recent film.
Yes.
And I know that Richard Stanley, he's working from a story that is strange. It's already Lovecraft. There is some dialogue that could, in the wrong hands, come off as clunky, but you really have to sell that this thing is happening, that this meteorite is you know, kind of tearing the fabric apart. And I think, you know, the entire cast is up to the task to sell that dialogue. And I was wondering if you could talk about, you know, that process of being like, this is a little ridiculous, but we have to say this and we have to make it real.
Yes. I mean, I feel like something that Brendan Meyer, who plays Benny in the movie, that we kind of talked about was...
Your brother.
He plays my brother in the movie. We kind of talked about when there's this big moment that happens with Jolie and Julian's characters, and we kind of looked at it rather than this kind of science fiction, hard to compute to your brain kind of experience, and we looked at it more as if our mother, like, had cancer, which is also something that she did have before the movie begins, but looking at it as a kind of illness, and then also.
Because there are some
crazy kind of things that happen.
Effects,
so, like,
yeah.
Things that you can use to ground it. And, like, my thing when, like, with the, like, pernicious approach of the color, my whole thing is that my gut is really affected from the sound. Mm-hmm. So using your gut, that can help ground you rather than just going, the sound is affecting me. And Richard was really good about being like, it makes you feel sick. So then that's something that... we all can relate to is when something makes us feel nauseous. Mm-hmm. And then also with the dialogue, as you were saying, well, there was a lot of room for improv. Richard was really open to improv, and Nick is, I mean, a class act at improv. So there was room to keep us on our toes and to make sure that we found the footing with the dialogue. So mm-hmm. nothing ever felt, you know, completely out of this world. The movie's out of this world, but the dialogue's not.
Like, oh, okay. Grounding all of this in the same way that the meteor is grounded.
I mean, it was hilarious. Every time we said alpacas, they're lovely animals. But it was like, I love just when you get to, like, say the alpaca lines. Those are so fun.
It was yeah, because the family has alpacas, and
yes.
Nick Cage's character is constantly talking about how expensive they are and how they need to be taken care of, and milking the alpacas.
That's a scene to look out for. I think it's absolutely hilarious.
Yeah, it's a beautiful one. We're gonna take a quick break, and when we come back, we're gonna talk a little bit about Spike Jonze and his kind of method of working with actors and approaching the story, and a little bit more Nick Cage talk too, because there's a lot of process that is really fascinating. So we'll be right back.
Hey, J. Keith.
Hey, Helen. I hear you have a true-false quiz you want me to finish.
I do. Here we begin. We host a trivia game show podcast on the Max Fun Network called Go Fact Yourself.
True.
Correct. The show is all about celebrity guests answering trivia questions about things J. Keith enjoys.
False. We sometimes don't talk about baseball or cats.
Thank God. It's questions about things they enjoy. Next, we bring on surprise experts every episode.
True.
Correct. Final question. It's just the two of us sitting alone with these guests.
False.
Correct. We have a live audience at the Angel City Brewery. See? You can hear Go Fact Yourself every first and third Friday of the month. And if you don't listen, you can go fact yourself.
True.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Madeline Arthur, and we're talking about adaptation. So something I wanted to talk about was Chris Cooper, who is a really lovely and kind of authoritative actor who, when you see him, you're like, oh, God, that guy. I love him. And he plays the Orchid Thief here in adaptation. He had some interesting things to say about working with Spike Jonze, and I wanted to bring some of that up. He said, quote, when I first met Spike at the audition, we came to an interesting conclusion that led to how we would shoot the scenes I was involved with. Usually when you go to the audition, you're lucky if you get two readings of a scene. And I went out on a limb and I said, please, please allow me to show you some interpretations. I thought LaRoche was wide open in every scene, and we tried five or six things, and we decided then how we would shoot the scenes, modulating between those in the audition. And thought that was really lovely.
Wow.
I mean, first off, it's just like,
they both
know.
Sound so lovely.
Yeah. Because Chris Cooper, he's a professional. That guy shows up and is automatically a presence
yes.
on every screen.
He has one of my favorite lines in the movie, too.
Oh, what's that?
Which is, I just think the way he delivers it, it's iconic. When he's in the courtroom and he says, he's talking all about the orchids and he goes,
probably the smartest person I know.
I mean, it's just so good. But yeah. Anyways, yeah.
He's so charismatic. But I love that Spike Jones was open to just being like, yeah, let's take the time and
yes.
we'll see if you can do it. I mean, maybe if it were another actor who weren't Chris Cooper, maybe he wouldn't have kind of given them like the benefit of just like taking the time
and
for
the collaboration.
For that. Yeah, but I mean, I would kind of hope that you might. But it is really interesting. Audition processes are kind of grueling, I think, from the actors that I've spoken to, the ones that I've been involved in, the fact that you're kind of given a little piece of the script and you get, sometimes you just have to tape it and that's it. You just get one or two and they're not going to look at you after that. And it maybe doesn't help the process. You might overlook people who could be doing something different if you just gave them direction, you know, what you wanted. But I was curious if you could maybe illuminate us on some of those things.
On the audition process.
Did you have to audition for Color Out of Space?
Actually, this was a huge, huge honor because I did not. So thank you to Danielle Afiero and Amber Horm, the casting directors, and everyone at Spectre and Richard. But it was I received the script, and by the next day, I knew I was going to Portugal. So that was a really, I will be forever grateful for the rest of my life for that experience.
Yeah.
And to forego the auditioning process, like we were talking about. I mean, I love self-tapes. I think that you kind of get to make them into your own little art piece, and you can send different takes. So if you have different ideas, you don't have to go in and just have your one chance to show one.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, but
do you just
also,
set up your iPhone and or like
well, it depends. If I'm traveling, I have this great tripod. It weighs 1 pound. I can take it everywhere. And then sometimes I go and tape with a person as well in a studio because they have the lighting and it all works so well.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time with self-tapes, sometimes you can zig when they want you to zag. So you might not quite you can't get the direction that you get in the room, and then it depends when you go into the room. Some casting directors take so much time and they'll let you try things different ways and they'll play around with it and ask for input or like ask just to change even one line, and that's always just the dream when that happens, because you really get the opportunity to work with the scenes and work with the characters, because it's a giant masterclass auditioning, playing multiple different characters in a week. And I feel like your skill keeps getting better and better. But then sometimes you go into an audition room and you understand, because time's short and you have one chance at the scene, and that's what it is. And that's kind of the reality of it.
I mean, we should maybe talk about the fact that when Charlie Kaufman wrote this, it was like he was doing it in secret. And Spike Jones was talking about Ed Saxon, the man who had actually secured the rights for The Orchid Thief and who hired Charlie Kaufman, and who was just like tapping his watch like,
yes.
Hey, when's the script going to come? And he got it. And so Jones said he was expecting an adaptation of The Orchid Thief, this book he'd already put a couple of years of work into developing, seeking out a writer that would be appropriate for it and trusting Charlie. Then all of a sudden he got this thing that was written by two people with Charlie's quote-unquote brother writing part of the movie. So I think Ed's first read through it, he didn't really read it. So he gave it to a friend of his and they said, God, this is great. And he read it a couple of days later after sort of returning back to normal. And I think he realized this is incredible. But wow. I mean, that's something, though, I appreciate that Ed Saxon actually gave it to someone else to read and said, like, maybe I don't have the clarity of thought or mind to know that this script by a fictional person is good.
Totally. Well, you hear so many times about scripts just getting passed on because they're read by one person or in the publishing world as well. To have the wherewithal to pass it on to someone else and realize that I think it's one of the best scripts that's been written. It's so playful and just, it has so many different levels to it that I feel like I've seen the movie a couple times now, and there aren't many movies that I go back and rewatch just because I have so many movies on my movie list.
Yeah, totally.
But Adaptation is one of those that I'd go back and rewatch because I feel like you glean something different from it every time, and there's just another aspect to it that you didn't see when you watched it before.
Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, it's a movie that I love the message, and there's one thing that Charlie Kaufman knew how to do, and I think that he respected the work of Susan Orlean. And so even though he was writing something different, he respected her and her work, and he knew when to put her lines from the book in it. And so there's one line from the book that he definitely had to have in there, and it was, quote, "I want to know how it feels to care about something passionately." And he was like, okay, this is clearly what the book is about. And he, you know, found that kernel of what it's about and then extrapolated that. And I think that any movie that has some kind of drive to think about what is driving us or what is driving another person, you know, that's obviously going to have a kind of urgency to it.
Absolutely. And I think that throughout the whole movie, he's kind of talking about how he wants it to be about the beauty of flowers. And I think that he succeeds in making it this beautiful movie about flowers, but also about human existence and life itself and the human behavior. And for the first three quarters of the movie, kind of in this not simple way at all, but just this very, I'm going to use the word beautiful again.
sometimes it's the only word.
All you can think of, but just in this very naturalistic way, and then towards the end when you see it kind of take that turn after he goes to Robert McKee's thing, and then kind of in the most fantastical way goes against, I feel like, what his screenwriting stands for, but makes it this just incredible movie.
he turns his movie into a thriller, even as he's fighting these impulses that McKee and all these people are saying, like, do a thriller, you know, do an action movie. Mm-hmm. And he's just like kind of embracing it, but in the weirdest way.
And like you hear him say in the movie, like, I don't want there to be a car chase. And then four scenes later, there's like a bit of a car chase.
Yeah. But, you know, like it's essentially saying that, like, you can't fight what life is handing to you.
Yes.
You have to kind of submit to the process and submit to it. And that's, you know, kind of how he was approaching this story. We skipped over a little bit, but I am curious, you know, like, going back to Ed Sachsen, do you feel like there are times when you don't have the clarity of mind to read a script and you need someone else to tell you if it's, like, if it's good or it's good for you?
Ooh, I mean, I feel like I'm so open to all types of stories and genres and scripts, and I don't think I've kind of come to that point yet.
Mm-hmm.
And I do, my mom is hugely supportive of me, and I love to have her read a lot of my scripts, and we work on things together. So it's always good to have someone else's voice and to have other insight into the script, and also sometimes working with an acting coach. But I feel like...
And I think people don't realize that actors throughout their lives work with acting coaches. It's not like, oh, I'm the best.
I think that a lot of actors still work with acting coaches. I don't all the time. I used to work with them all from all projects, but not so much anymore. But I think it's really important to have outside opinions and insight, and to challenge you and challenge how you look at the work. And so you become a better actor and you don't stagnate, and they help you grow and only get better. And there are a lot of actors that are really established and accomplished that I believe still work with coaches from time to time, I think for that reason.
Yeah. I mean, it's what Nick Cage is saying in these interviews, too. It's just like you have to kind of stretch yourself or you will get
well, otherwise,
bored and
boring. You'll get bored. Exactly. And you know, two brains or three brains are mightier than one. So use whatever you can. And one thing that I love about Nick is that he really draws inspiration from so many things in life, from movies, like, and there's this thing where he was I read in his like New York Times article drawing from like reptiles or animals. Like I just think it makes it a lot more exciting. It brings, I feel like, a bigger vibrancy and energy to characters.
I mean, does working with him, working with Julie Richardson, all these, you know, great actors, you've done a lot. You're still young in your career. Does it make you does it expand your vision of what you could be doing? Or did you try something new out with like your newest projects, or how are you?
I mean, I feel like I look up to them both so much, and all the actors I've worked with, and I try to learn, pick up things from them and learn through osmosis and take in all that they're doing. And with Nick, I feel like talking about kind of the bold choices that he makes and things that you'd read on the page and you'd just never expect to see come to life. Like, you just would never think of that choice yourself. So it definitely kind of broadens your perspective and how you look at scenes. And there was this song, this isn't really necessarily bringing a specific kind of sensibility or sense to the work, but we learned this song from Nick on set one night when we were all getting I was getting like kind of giddy. It was late at night.
Mm-hmm.
And he taught us this song, When You Have to Act, that he came up with. And it goes like this. It goes, the camera's rolling, the lights are on, the director calls action, the director calls cut. Act, 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 everybody, act, act, act. And it's such a funny song and so upbeat, and it makes you smile and laugh, and it kind of like resets you back to zero if you're feeling a little tired or something. So I didn't really do it out, like, fully out loud. I think I tried once, and then I got a bit shy around my other actors on another project. They're like, what are you doing?
Like, who is this woman?
But, like, in my head, like, if it was a night shoot, and I was like, this, like, I need to click into it or snap into it, I would think that in my head, because I also had such a special and magical experience working with him and with everyone that it just brought me a lot of joy. And an acting teacher once said, like, the best work comes from a place of joy, even if you're doing a sad scene. Mm-hmm. So I take that song with me.
That is a great place for us to take a break, because when we come back, we're going to talk about Spike Jonze and enthusiasm on set. And so we'll be right back. And also, I want to get into some of Charlie Kaufman's best advice that he gave and get your thoughts on that. We'll be right back.
Hi, I am Lori Kilmartin.
And I'm Jackie Cashin.
Together, we host a podcast called
The Jackie and Lori Show.
We're both stand-up comics. We recently met each other because women weren't allowed to work together on the road or in gigs for a long, long time. And so our friendship has been unfolding on this podcast for a couple of years. Jackie constantly works the road. I write for Conan, and then I work the road in between.
We do a lot of stand-up comedy, and so we celebrate stand-up, and
yes,
we also bitch about it.
We keep it to an hour. We don't have any guests. We somehow find enough to talk about every single week. So find us. You can subscribe to The Jackie and Lori Show at Maximum Fun. .org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, bye.
And welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. Again, I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Madeline Arthur, and we're talking about adaptation. So I had mentioned before enthusiasm. This is what Chris Cooper had said. He said, quote, this is a 53-day shoot. My one word for Spike and what I so needed every day to come to work was his enthusiasm, his boyish quality and the joy to be on the set. So I think it's lovely that you also say that, and that's what you're trying to infuse into your work days.
Yes. And I mean, I feel like also Nick and Jolie on Color to Space set that tone. They're both so passionate and happy to be there. And Nick is such a huge cinephile and would come to set with this enthusiasm for the scenes and have all these ideas and just be like, are we making a movie? So what's happening?
Mm-hmm.
And so to see an actor like that who's made so many movies and been in the industry so long and still be a massive fan of filmmaking and film was just so wonderful to see that spark is still completely there and the passion.
Meryl Streep had some great things to say too. We haven't really gotten to her, but she said that essentially this movie felt like it had a feeling of a small film, even though it had big ambitions, and that was something that drew her to working on it. She said, quote, Spike Jonze and his cinematographer would come to work in little suits and ties like Hitchcock and his guy. There was a lot of whimsy. You could misconstrue it as something non-serious, but I have rarely worked with a director so beautifully prepared. This is an enormous movie to make on not a big budget. The leanness and economy with which he drove the day, but with an effortless feel that made it fun. You can be involved in films where big, heavy machinery is squashing everybody against the studio walls, and this is not that. And I thought that was lovely. I didn't realize they came to set with, like, little suits on.
Right? This sounds just like the dream set. Now she says, like, that dash of whimsy. I mean, that just sounds gorgeous to have a director who seems so collaborative and passionate and wearing a suit to set and showing up. I feel like that's so fitting to the movie.
Oh, yeah. That's something to think and talk about, is the fact that, you know, your director is setting the tone. So how they show up on set is actually going to kind of leak into the aura and consciousness of the actors and all the technicians and crew who are working on this movie.
Yes, and like on Colorado Space, our director Richard Stanley, how he showed up to set and is just a wealth of information regarding H.P. Lovecraft, on which the movie, our movie is based on a short story by the same name, and how he's so into witchcraft and magic, and he kind of set that tone for this kind of this mystical quality, as well as the location we were filming at, but definitely, and also the glee and passion from him. He was so passionate about the material, and before every action, you could just hear the glee in his voice, or if you were not in that particular take, you could see it. And to have someone like that, and when you get to work with people who have all just come together for something that they are truly putting their all into is the absolute best.
One thing I wanted to talk about too with Meryl Streep was the fact that everyone was like, why doesn't Nick Cage do these movies all the time with adaptation? And Meryl Streep had actually answered for him and was just like, well, you wait for something as a script. You know, they don't come every 6 months. I've seen some pretty good ones, and this one just grabbed me by the throat, but you don't get them all the time. And I think he kind of felt like, it seemed like Nick Cage had to be a little bit defensive about that, because people were like, where'd you go, man? Because, you know, he was doing action films.
He hasn't gone anywhere.
Yeah, and he's like, I don't think I went anywhere. Yeah. I think I did some of the best action films of the 1990s and early 2000s. And I think that Meryl Streep is exactly correct in that, where it's just like, well, you're still depending upon the writers, you know. But as an actor, do you feel like there's any kind of ability? Like, are you just kind of waiting? Or are you trying to search things out? Like, what do you do spending your time?
Well, I would love to say that I have the luxury at this point in my career to wait for terrific scripts. But I feel
just
like
sitting at home,
yeah,
drinking
just sitting
tea,
at home drinking tea,
refreshing the email.
I mean, hopefully one day that would be the goal, to just be able to have the choice to carve out exactly the kind of career you want. But I think, I mean, right now it is obviously, you'll get a script in sometimes where you just really connect with it, and the writing is so strong, and you're like, oh, I just hope I get a call back on this, or I make it to that next step, Because it's true, even when in auditioning, not all scripts are created equally. But I do think that it's important to always realize the hard work that goes into each one of them. Just like when you see a movie and some people are like, oh, I didn't like that movie. And it's like, well, I'm really easy to please, actually. I think I enjoy almost every movie. And not just because
Madeline
I'm in the industry.
The best critic.
Yeah, I would be an awful critic. But it's like, you know all the people on set that went into making it.
Yeah.
And like, their heart was probably in the right place, even if the final product was something iffy. And so I appreciate every movie that's made.
Yeah. I mean, that's something I think about too. When I see, like, you know, like these great young actors, yourself included, that I hope the scripts come, and I hope that the depth of the roles continue to exist, because you know, I get worried when there might be a younger actor, specifically a female actor, who is maybe kind of getting shallower parts or kind of gets to like be in the side. And what you're saying, you know, transformational, that would be kind of ideal, I would think, for a lot of these younger actors. And I'm not sure that those stories are always being told.
No, I think maybe I have to write one.
I read
I
that you
more
do
and
write.
More friends. Oh, I've written some scenes, but I plan on writing full scripts. But I have a lot of female friends and friends in general who are writing their own material, and I've been so my schedule's been so full this last year. I haven't really had. I mean, you can make time. You can always make time to do things. So there's no excuses. But I would like
Jesus,
to start writing more.
Get your act together, Madeline. So I wanted to bring up, this is a longer quote from Charlie Kaufman, and it's actually one that he had included in his speech at the BFI. And it, you know, it's something that I think about as a writer when I'm making some things. And I'm going to read it to you, and then I'll just kind of get your thoughts on it how it affects your career. He said, quote, "People all over the world spend countless hours of their lives being fed entertainment in the forms of movies, TV shows, newspapers, YouTube videos, and it's ludicrous to believe this stuff doesn't alter our brains. It's also equally ludicrous to believe that at least this mass distraction and manipulation is not convenient for the people in charge. People are starving. They may not know it, but they're being fed mass-produced garbage. The packaging is colorful and it's loud, but it's being produced in the same factories that make Pop-Tarts and iPads by people sitting around saying, what can we do to make people buy more of these? And they're very good at their jobs. But that's what it is you're getting, because that's what they're making. They're selling you something. And the world is built on this now. Politics and government are built on this. Corporations are built on this. Interpersonal relationships are built on this. And we're starving, all of us. And we're killing each other, and we're hating each other, and we're calling each other liars and evil, because it's all become marketing and we want to win, because we're lonely and empty and scared, and we're led to believe winning will change all that. But there is no winning. What can be done? Say who you are. Really say it in your life and your work. Tell someone out there who is lost, someone not yet born, someone who won't be born for 500 years. Your writing will be a record of your time. It can't help but be. But more importantly, if you are honest about who you are, you'll help that person be less lonely in their world, because that person will recognize themselves in you, and that will give them hope. It's done so for me, and I have to keep rediscovering its profound importance in my life. Give that to the world, rather than selling something to the world." Do you find that you are at times caught up in the idea of, like, I must get a role, instead of, you know, thinking about, you know, what is this in my future? What is this? What am I saying? You know, where are you at in your process now?
In my process now? No, I think that I've always been conscious of kind of what am I saying? And especially now I have a little bit more of the opportunity.
Yeah.
And I think you always do. You always do have that opportunity, but sometimes it's more difficult to have that to be able to make those choices than other times. And I think that what I took from the first half of that, her first half of that quote, is kind of, you are what you eat. And and I think that we should always be aware of why we're telling this story and what message we're trying to send out, because is that not ultimately, at least in my opinion, kind of why we storytell? Yes, as actors, one of the greatest joys is like exploring human behavior and delving into these people that you don't meet every day and are not yourself, but also the story as a whole and why the world needs that story in that specific moment.
I think that's a great place for us to wrap up. And I just want to thank you for coming. And I would love for you to tell people how they can see Color Out of Space.
You can see Color Out of Space starting tomorrow, Friday, January 24th, in theaters everywhere. Please try to go and see it in a theater. The visuals are so much more vivid on the big screen and the score as well. So Friday, January 24th, Color Out of Space is in theaters near you. Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you.
It's been really fun.
And thank you for listening to Switchblade Sisters. If you like what you're hearing, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. VFD42 says, this podcast feels really special. Gabriella Ledesma's episode instantly became one of my favorites. She has been such an amazing story, and I loved hearing her talk about Psycho. I hope she comes back on soon. I am so glad this podcast exists and that Maximum Fun exists. Everyone should subscribe. I absolutely agree. If you want to let us know what you think of the show, you can tweet at us at Switchblade Pod or email us at SwitchbladeSisters@MaximumFun.org. And please check out our Facebook group. That's Facebook.com/groups/SwitchbladeSisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of MaximumFun.org.
Probably the smartest person I know.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.